Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases, ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in passed by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much-criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants, and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education, or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticized for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalization, terrorism, and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at Al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that, God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike, demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November. Prominent figures who rushed to welcome al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike, and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Kuzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategies, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but redevelopment being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted. According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Basically, the front lines were a place where you could easily see sincerity and warmth. Everyone had a friendly relationship with others. In that arena, some people practiced sincerity and showed their divine intentions in action. We can also refer to their spiritual qualities, their midnight tears, their dawn prayers, their monotheistic enthusiasm and love, and their indifference to material trifles, and in certain cases, we witnessed their connection with Alamul Ghaib, the unseen world. Some of those dear ones and those mystic youth, mystic in the true sense of the word, had developed such spirituality in the front lines that they could see and predict the future. They could see their martyrdom, the martyrdom of their comrades, and the event that would happen. These points exist in soldiers' biographies, and they are really important.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be
Of course, it is evident that the last point existed more than the others, thanks to Islam. Of course, prominence in other areas existed thanks to religious faith as well. But in particular, the last point originated from entrusting one's heart to God, to Islam, and to religious faith. One becomes really astonished at the effect of such deep faith. For example, martyrs' mothers had such deep faith. Well, you and I do not understand motherly affection at all. No one except for mothers themselves can really understand motherly feelings. However, these mothers sent their youth to the front lines. When their children went to them to ask for their permission, they responded, "Because you are going there for the sake of Islam, you may go." When they brought them the bodies of their youth, they expressed their joy at having offered them in the way of God.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
Even after Trump appointed bureaucrat Emily W. Murphy of the General Services Administration signed a letter enabling Biden to start working with federal agencies and prepare for a transition of power, Donald Trump has personally continued to resist conceding. What is he after with his bogus legal challenges of a rigged and stolen election? Can he really hope for a legislative coup? Is the contemporary United States a country divided not merely on political and ideological issues among its body politic, but more frighteningly along different conceptions of reality? Public intellectual Noam Chomsky sheds light on these questions with groundbreaking insights in this exclusive interview for Truth Out. Stay tuned, please, for this interview, which is published under the heading Noam Chomsky Says Trump Has Revealed the Extreme Fragility of American Democracy. Campaign continues to mount legal challenges to the electoral process, pushing outrageous falsehoods While Rudy Giuliani has gone so far as to make outlandish claims of a vast global conspiracy to steal the election from the great leader. In your view, what is really behind Trump's legal challenges?
Speculation, of course, but I'll indulge in a bad dream, which could become reality if we are not on guard, and if we fail to recognize that elections should be a brief interlude in a life of engaged activism, not a time to go home and leave matters in the hands of the victors. I suspect that Trump and associates regard their legal challenges as a success in what seems a plausible strategy. Keep the pot boiling and keep the loyal base at fever pitch, furious about the stolen election and the efforts of the insidious elites and the deep state to remove their savior from office. That strategy seems to be working well. According to recent opinion polls, 75%, or 77% of Trump backers say Biden's win was due to fraud. And the anger among Trump's base is tied to a belief that the election was stolen. Rejection of the legal challenges with ridicule may please liberal circles, but for the base, it may be simply more proof of the Trump thesis. The hated elites will stop at nothing in their machinations. Meanwhile, this strategy requires keeping the wrecking ball, Trump's symbol, actively at work. Do nothing to deal with the pandemic, even delay in providing data to Biden's team, while a top nurses' union warns of catastrophic death in the growing chaos, whilst our hospitals are knowingly still not prepared and the government is on vacation. Viewed through the lens of this vast strategy, if the pandemic gets worse, so much the better. Then local officials will try to impose restrictions and even lockdowns to control patriotic Americans, in line with the plans of the supposed communist-run deep state, leading to economic harm and intrusions on normal life. Meanwhile, Trump and his associates could abandon other normal governmental activities so that when Biden establishes what they describe as a fake government on Inauguration Day, the immediate problems will be severe and failure likely. On that day, which will live in infamy among the faithful, Trump might set up what he claims is an authentic government in Mar-a-Lago, with a Mitch McConnell Senate in his pocket and a furious popular base. The next step would be to make the country ungovernable, a speciality that McConnell has been perfecting for a decade, and that an accomplished demagogue like Donald Trump can manage reflexively. Everything that goes wrong can be blamed on the treacherous elites. Trump and associates might, as some have speculated, set up an alternative media empire, incorporating talk radios and other far-right media outlets, but perhaps not Fox Channel, which has shown occasional signs of disobedience. Then, they could come roaring back into power in 2022 to 2024, feeding on growing discontent. They would then be free to destroy the environment with abandon and maximize short-term profit for their primary constituency, impose discipline on what remains of government, tame the media, institute harsh authoritarian measures elsewhere, and continue with their abject service to their masters, the real elites, the very rich, and the corporate sector, the decision makers, as recent academic research once again establishes very clearly.
Trump's hopes for denying a Biden election win lie with a legislative revolt, that is, by overturning the certification process. Experts indicate that such an outcome has a very slim chance of taking place, yet the fact that it is even considered as a possibility surely reveals something utterly problematic about the way democracy functions in the United States of America. Can you share your views with us on this matter and discuss what it would take to make the democratic process in the U.S. actually democratic?
Whatever the validity of my speculation about the goals and success of Trump's strategy, the whole election reveals the extreme fragility of American democracy. It is amazing enough that someone whose malevolent decision to provoke an out-of-control pandemic has just killed tens of thousands of Americans can even run for office, even carry much of the country with him, and that the political party that virtually shines his shoes can win a resounding victory at every level apart from the White House. That's putting aside Trump's major achievements, driving to near-term environmental catastrophe and sharply increasing the threat of terminal war, crimes that scarcely registered in the electoral process. Trump's rejection of the election result is just the coda to his quite impressive campaign to accomplish an authoritarian takeover, with the executive purge, whilst his close associate Mitch McConnell converts the Senate into a joke, functioning almost entirely to enrich the rich, and stack the judiciary with young far-right justices whose task will be to impose the ultra-reactionary Trump-McConnell agenda for a generation. We have just endured 40 years of regression, the neoliberal regime, a bitter assault against democracy and the kind of society that can sustain it. An estimate of the monetary cost to the general population was recently given by the Rand Corporation. $47 trillion transferred from the working and middle classes, 90% of the population that is, to the super rich, the top 0.1%, doubled their share of wealth to 20% of the total since the Ronald Reagan administration. The Rand Corporation figures are a considerable underestimate. Tens of trillions of dollars more were transferred after Reagan opened the spigots for tax havens, shell companies and other devices to rob the public. More were developed under Clinton's deregulatory mania. Reagan and his partner Margaret Thatcher moved at once to undermine the labor movement, setting in motion the campaigns to deprive working people of their primary means to resist the assault. The serious decline of functioning democracy is a virtual corollary to the radical concentration of wealth and dispatch of much of the general population to stagnation and precarity. There is no need to review the rest of the sordid story once again, but it is important to remember the deep roots of the undemocratic structure of the government.
Millions of Trump's supporters seem to believe that their leader actually won the election. In fact, there have been even signs claiming world knows Trump won. How do you explain this peculiar phenomenon?
It is also important to consider the devastating impact of the neoliberal regime on much of the country, with particular severity in rural areas that were also major centers of manufacturing. After steady growth for many years, employment in manufacturing sector declined from its 1979 peak of almost 20 million people to under 13 million 40 years later. The decline was in large part the result of policy choices, bipartisan investor rights agreements, mislabeled free trade agreements, which provided unparalleled protection and other rights to corporate power, while setting working people in competition with the most poorly paid and repressed workers in the world. That has been a large factor in the devastation of rural America, towns depopulated or abandoned, no jobs or hospitals or other services, general malaise and a justified sense of having been abandoned. That's hardly conducive to participation in the most advanced sectors of global culture. The source of the divide you mention are complex. The split, however, is very real. And it has major impacts as well. Right now, the country is in the grips of a severe pandemic. It was understood by scientists in 2003, after containment of the SARS epidemic, that another coronavirus was likely to appear. The cultural divide soon emerged. When Barack Obama took office in 2009, one of his first acts was to convene the President's Scientific Advisory Council to request them to provide a pandemic response plan, and they did. It was implemented and remained in force until January of 2017, when one of Donald Trump's first acts was to dismantle it, opening the most anti-science administration in modern American history, with consequences that we have seen on many fronts, and with effects on popular culture. The conflict of epistemologies is real. It is no simple matter to explain or to deal with it. The future will depend substantially on how this conflict is resolved.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
When it comes to the issue of human rights in Saudi Arabia, it's a well-known fact that there is minimal existence of this in the kingdom. Opposition is not only condemned, but could consist of jail time. The regime is back in the spotlight, with the continued detention of at least five women's rights activists. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the abysmal human rights record in Saudi Arabia, and how member countries of the so-called international community continue their dealings with Saudi Arabia, one of their initiatives being economic gains.
Seven out of the nine European countries which have appointed human rights ambassadors have criticized the continued detention of women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. In a statement, the ambassadors of the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Estonia, Luxembourg and Finland call for the release of all political detainees in Saudi Arabia.
We remain deeply concerned by the continued detention of at least five women's rights activists in Saudi Arabia. Peaceful activism and advocating for women's rights is not a crime. We join the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, special rapporteurs and treaty bodies in reiterating our call for the release of all political detainees, including women's rights activists.
The envoy especially drew attention to the cases of two activists, Lujain Al-Hathloul and Samar Badawi. Hathloul was put on trial last Wednesday after 900 days in prison, but her case was transferred to the Specialized Criminal Court. That's the institution that Amnesty International says is used to, quote, silence dissent. She is charged with attempting to destabilize the kingdom for defying Riyadh's ban on women's driving 1 month before it was officially lifted in June 2018. The case of Badawi, who had also campaigned against a driving ban, was earlier sent to the same court. Along with the European Human Rights Envoys, Chairman of the US House Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff has also called for the immediate release of the activists. But both the Europeans and the US have so far only paid lip service to the Saudi suppression of dissent and other gross human rights violations. Saudis have a long list of violations of human rights. They have led a deadly crackdown on a decade-long uprising in the oil-rich and Shia-majority eastern province, especially in Katif region, where protesters seek an end to discrimination and political marginalization. That's beside what Human Rights Watch calls infringement on freedom of expression, association and belief, as well as migrant workers' rights. Riyadh has also helped Bahrain quash the 2011 uprising for democracy, supported an armed Takfiri terrorist in Syria, and has been leading a bloody war of aggression on Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children. But silence has been Western countries' reaction to Riyadh's role in Bahrain and Syria. And in Yemen, the West has encouraged and supported the Saudis by continuing to sell the kingdom the arms it uses to kill civilians. These are besides sweeping the Jamal Khashoggi case under the rug after the US Central Intelligence and the UN clearly linked his murder to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Riyadh appears to have carte blanche on abusing human rights, which limits Western reactions to his crimes to occasionally strongly worded statements. Actions, however, remain lacking thanks to Europeans and the US's lucrative trade deals with Saudi Arabia.
Joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. We have author and academic Lawrence Davidson joining us from Westchester. I'd like to welcome you both. Lawrence Davidson, I'm going to first start with you and just pretty much ask you a very, very simple question. Saudi Arabia, human rights, what comes to your mind immediately?
Well, what comes to my mind is a dictatorship that uses religion as a cover, and an economic the economic resources it has to essentially buy the silence of everybody else. There's other things that are going on here. And it's not only the economic deals that you've mentioned in the introduction. There is there's a reluctance on the part of the international community, which is a nation-based community, to seriously interfere in the what they consider to be the internal affairs of other countries. And this is an age-old principle. It started to break down after the Second World War, and the example we got with the Holocaust and the Stalinist concentration camps that he ran in the West, and so that started to deteriorate. But now it's back. So the reluctance to have anyone interfere in another country's what is considered their internal affairs is something that holds back these countries from going beyond strong statements. And it's also what underlies vetoes, often vetoes in the Security Council and that sort of thing. So it's got a history to it.
Okay, the reason why we have this topic for this debate, Daniel Azar, is the case of five women, which has been highlighted, especially with these five European countries, for example, who are deeply concerned about their detention, because right now they've been referred to the Special Criminal Court for terrorism and national security. One of them is this lady by the name of Hathloui, who was targeted because of a law barring women from driving, which later, obviously, that law was annulled. So tell us what you think that somebody was detained for that is now in a court, a special criminal court for terrorism and national security.
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia is quite simply the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, and that includes us, North Korea, other terrifying dictatorships, but Saudi Arabia is in a class by itself. First of all, the country is wholly owned by the Al Saud, the House of Saud. It's really their private property. They treat it as their private property. They monopolize political power, and they simply do not grant the slightest rights to other people who live there. In the case of this woman who was arrested, it's a classic example of what happened in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, knew he had to loosen the regulations banning women from driving for purely international reasons. He did so, but at the same time, he clamped down on women agitating for that right from within, because he can't tolerate any kind of challenge to his authority, no matter how mild, no matter how circumspect, even if he agrees with what the challengers are calling for. So it's a total dictatorship, a total crackdown, and one which allows for absolutely no free expression by individuals outside the royal family. And even within the royal family, I might add, there's a reign of terror that prevents any kind of criticism of Mohammed bin Salman or his father, King Salman.
Well, Lawrence Davidson, you mentioned the economic gains here. I'm looking at the fact that you have these five European countries that have come out and made these statements. But what is a checklist when it comes to dealing with Saudi Arabia? I mean, when these countries like the U.S., like the U.K. or France, take a look at this checklist when it comes to the issue of human rights, well, they're going to go down and see, well, you know, people are being put in jail, there are sham trials, and there's a war that they're killing people in Yemen, for example. And yet they're dealing with them. They're dealing with the Saudi regime, going to the G20, giving them, again, another stamp of approval, of acceptance in the business community, per se. So that kind of sounds like double standards when it comes to the so-called international community.
Oh, absolutely. And if you're looking for morality in international affairs, it's not... it's not there in any driving or practical way. After the Second World War, lip service was paid. It was thought required to be paid to human rights because of the horrors of the Holocaust and other genocides that were coming down the line and all this sort of thing. So you had the international community, particularly Western countries, taking a verbal stand against that. But when it comes to diplomatic relations, when it comes to economic profit, all of these countries, one way or another, they have important companies that are making money off of Saudi Arabia, and so they feel that they have to maintain that double standard. And again, it's the history of international relations that in fact you do not bring morality into it in any serious way. Here in the United States, there's been a long-standing debate between idealists and realists. Realists are those who, want to dispense with morality when it comes to international relations, and they generally have won the argument. It's not a surprise. And I don't think it's going to change under Biden, certainly. And this is the way it is until we can resurrect some sort of, morality, standards of morality for international relationships. International law seems presently dead in the water.
Well, there was almost a total embrace when it came to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince Daniel Lazar, when he introduced his reform agenda. I mean, you have headlines like the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, power behind the throne. And then there was a shakedown that happened where you had all these wealthy businessmen, some of them princes, at the Ritz-Carlton, alongside people being jailed. And then you had the assassination of Khashoggi, which was in the worst way with the dismemberment, etc. So what happened to the reform agenda? I mean, when we talk about the way that Saudi Arabia is still being embraced, whilst it has committed these atrocious crimes that are in the human rights arena, it's basically giving it a stamp of approval to continue dealing with it.
Yes, yeah, so you've got to bear in mind that not only is Saudi Arabia the most undemocratic country on the face of the earth, it's also the sick man of the Middle East. Its political institutions are in disarray. Its economy is a wreck thanks to the fall in oil prices. MBS's attempts to diversify the economy have gone nowhere. And the reign of terror that MBS is conducting will eventually backfire and will eventually lead to his own doing. He's a dictator isolated in his palace. He's surrounded by enemies on all sides. It's only a matter of time before he falls. And if he falls, there will be chaos. So that's what the Western countries, the so-called Western democracies, are trying to prevent. They're trying to uphold the Saudi regime by all means possible. If Mohammed bin Salman makes some kind of gesture towards reform, the U.S., Britain, France, etc., all cheer wildly, all in the hope that there's somehow this story will have a happy ending. But it won't. The regime can only crash and burn. It's profoundly unstable. Its days are numbered. We don't know how long it'll last. It could be days, could be years, could conceivably be even longer. But the handwriting is on the wall. This is a regime slated for self-destruction.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Lawrence Davidson, about an issue that many are not aware of, and that is the suppression that happens in the eastern Qatif region, where the Shia minority actually live. And we need to talk about that because these people are being suppressed. And also at the same time, we can compare that, this suppression, to what's happening to the Shias in Bahrain. So you, here you have these two brothers, namely Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, suppressing the Shia population in their countries. What's your take on that?
Well, these particular dictators, both in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, have been raised within this Sunni Muslim sect to see Shiites as dangerous, as heretics, and this sort of thing. And now, and in Saudi Arabia, you've got this sort of weird kind of situation where it's Shiites who work in the oil fields in the east, and so they're constantly under observation and suspect. So essentially, because the Sunni rulers expect or see the Shiites as dangerous and heretical, they expect an uprising, and so they suppress them and create the conditions for an uprising. It's not an indication that these guys are thinking things through. But it's an ideologically driven kind of hatred that they have. And so it's not surprising that the suppression of the Shiites in Saudi Arabia is longstanding. It's not new. And periodically, the Shiites react in stronger ways or less stronger ways, but it's ongoing. And it's certainly not surprising that the Saudis intervened to support the Sunni minority regime in Bahrain. So in both cases, they see this in terms of their internal interests to maintain their own dictatorship.
Daniel Azar, another thing that Saudi Arabia has been really critiqued for is this Sharia law, but not that Sharia in Muslim countries that practice it is something that's bad, but because a distorted version of it has been adopted by one of the worst entities that actually spelled danger for much of the world, and that was for the Daesh terrorists, who adopted this type of ideology in their own warped way. And many said that perhaps that emanated from Saudi Arabia. Do you see that being, that Saudi Arabia is guilty somewhat of that?
Oh, of course. I mean, listen, since 1979, the takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the Saudi royal family has been determined to burnish its credentials, its Islamic credentials, by exporting its own brand of Islam, which is a brand known as Wahhabism, which is extremely harsh, extremely intolerant, and which enforces a very unforgiving form of Sharia. So what we've seen throughout the Sunni world since 1979 has been the Wahhabization of the Sunni world. This is evident from Indonesia to the suburbs of Paris. And this has had a dramatic effect, and it's wreaked havoc both within the global Muslim community and also in terms of that community's relations with the outside world. It's promoted a very xenophobic, inward-looking, anti-modernist point of view, which has been disastrous for Muslims first and foremost. And of course, it's also driven the conflict with Iran. Bear in mind, anti-Shiaism goes to the heart of the Saudi regime. In 1803, I believe it was, the al-Saud launched an attack on, I believe it was Karbala, in which thousands of Shiites were killed. And so this strain of belief goes way back as far as the regime is concerned. And so the uh, the Al-Saud, the royal family, has placed itself at the disposal of the United States, which has used them as kind of their Praetorian guard to police the Middle East and impose a kind of a Wahhabist conformity throughout the Middle East in order to marshal opposition to Iran and its allies.
And finally, my question to you, Lawrence Davidson, you said that the incoming administration, if confirmed, once confirmed by in the U.S., is going to carry on as business as usual. Why do you say that? You don't think there will be a change in the way that it approaches Saudi Arabia, especially when it comes to things like the war in Yemen?
Yeah, well, my position on this is that economic relations with Saudi Arabia will continue as usual. It's much too lucrative for the economy, U.S. economy, which isn't in very good shape, to not do that. So Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, particularly in terms of economics. Now, with a proper amount of pushing on the part of the more progressive elements and maybe some of the people that he's actually bringing into the State Department and the NSA and what have you, we might be able to push him to withdraw U.S. support, active support, for the war in Yemen. There might be still U.S. naval ships in the area that help it in the blockade and what have you. It's likely that we can encourage Biden to remove that kind of support for the Saudi war in Yemen, but there will be no breakage of economic or diplomatic relations and this sort of thing, unless the Saudi prince oversteps his bounds. The killing of the journalist, which happened in another country, albeit in a Saudi embassy, but still, it happened in another country, in Turkey. And Khashoggi was an American, had an American green card. And so that kind of behavior comes very close to overstepping the bounds and requiring some sort of reaction. Now, he got away with that, at least with the Americans this time. If he tries that again, or if there's repeated examples of that, then he's going to get into trouble in the international environment.